What's the universal time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. British Prime Minister Theresa May has formally begun Britain's departure from the European Union after 44 years. She notified EU Council President Donald Tusk Wednesday in a letter. It comes 9 months after voters in the United Kingdom opted for Brexit. In an interview, Ms. May said she expects a period of adjustment after the two-year negotiating process.
We want to make sure that we are ending the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice and that we are able to control movement of people coming from the European Union. We want to have the agreements done in 2 years. There may, as I say, then be a period from which we're implementing those arrangements.
The EU Parliament's chief negotiator, Guy Verhofstadt, said the negotiations will be challenging.
I think it's absolutely naive to think that in 14, 15 months, you can negotiate everything. Withdrawal agreement, transition arrangements, and on top of that, all the details of a future partnership, including trade agreement, security agreement.
EU Commission leader Jean-Claude Juncker appealed for unity among the EU's remaining 27 members. A funeral for South African anti-apartheid activist Achmed Kathrada took on a political tone Wednesday, with criticism directed at President Jacob Zuma, who did not attend. Former Deputy President Galema Molante said Kathrada was deeply disturbed by the current post-apartheid failure of politics.
The position of president is one that must at all times unite this country behind a vision and program that seeks to make tomorrow a better day than today.
Kathrada, who died Tuesday at 87, had spoken out against corruption and the failings of the ruling African National Congress government, which was plagued by corruption and mismanagement allegations. This is VOA News. In Iraq, a suicide truck bomb exploded in southern Baghdad Wednesday, killing at least 15, wounding dozens. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but Islamic State has carried out similar attacks. In Washington, the commander of U.S. Central Command told lawmakers the U.S. may have played a role in a large explosion that killed dozens of civilians in western Mosul March 17th. General Joseph Votel said an investigation is underway.
The investigation will look at command and control. We'll look at the munitions we employed and the fusing for those munitions. It will look at intelligence. Importantly, it will look at the behavior of the enemy, and it will look at how our actions may have played a role in any civilian casualties.
Reports indicate an Islamic State truck bomb was parked near a building that collapsed from a large explosion at the time of U.S. airstrikes. Turkey Wednesday announced the end of its month-long campaign to rid its border area of Islamic State and Kurdish rebels in northern Syria. Operation Euphrates Shield was launched in August, resulting in the capture of several towns by rebels of the Free Syrian Army. President Donald Trump Wednesday hosted a listening session at the White House, part of a campaign pledge to try to stem America's worsening opioid addiction crisis.
Drug overdoses are now the leading cause of accidental death in our country, and opioid overdose deaths have nearly quadrupled since 1999. This is a total epidemic.
U.S. medical authorities said the number of opioid-involved overdose deaths has quadrupled since 1999. The chairman of the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee, North Carolina's Richard Burr, Wednesday pledged a thorough investigation into Russian involvement in last year's election and any alleged collusion between the Trump campaign and Moscow.
Tomorrow's hearing is to examine Russian capabilities, their capabilities to influence elections globally, what Russia has done in the past, which is important for us to bring to light for the American people, what they're doing today both here and throughout the world, and more importantly, what we should expect for the future.
A similar probe is underway in the other congressional chamber. South Korean electronics giant Samsung Wednesday unveiled its new Galaxy S8 smartphone after losing market share and money following the spate of battery fires in its Note 7s. Patrick Moorhead is with Moorhead Insights and Strategy.
Samsung had a lot to prove based on what happened with the Note 7. And I actually don't know how they pulled it off. Now, we'll have to see the price of the phone. We'll have to see how many they can ship and how consumers respond. But I feel like if they can bring this phone out, it's all behind them.
The Galaxy S8, scheduled to go on sale April 21st. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Mbatia in Washington. Today is Thursday, March 30th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A Kenyan High Court judge has ordered Parliament to pass a gender equity law in 60 days or face a possible dissolution.
It is provided for in the Constitution that if Parliament does not implement the requirements of the Constitution on balance of gender, anybody can go to court to have the court declare that Parliament has failed to do that, and then order Parliament.
John Nkirachu is a Parliament editor for the Daily Nation newspaper. Gabonese President Ali Bongo has opened a national dialogue, but the main opposition coalition has refused to take part. Zambian police denies stopping an opposition news conference, and the UN denies it is interfering in Zimbabwe's 2018 electoral process.
Totally false. It's not true. Because we work in everything with the government. In fact, every issue at UN engages, government is aware. We never deal on a political matters like that. We are working purely on development and humanitarian matters.
Besho Parajule is the UN resident coordinator in Zimbabwe. African health experts are concerned about maternal deaths in the face of looming health shortages, and China is poised to close its ivory factories by tomorrow, Friday. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A Kenyan High Court judge on Wednesday ordered Parliament to pass a gender equity law in 60 days or face a possibility of being dissolved. Kenya's male-dominated parliament had refused to implement the 2010 constitutional provision that no more than two-thirds of lawmakers should be men. A number of rights groups asked the court to force lawmakers to pass the gender equity law before the country votes on August 8 this year. Judge John Mativo accused Parliament of gross violation of the Constitution. John Nkirachu is the Parliament editor for the Daily Nation newspaper. He says while the court ruling is in line with the Constitution, getting Parliament to meet the 60-day deadline might be difficult because normally it takes at least 180 days to get a bill passed in Parliament.
I don't think that is likely to happen. First, you need at least 180 days to pass the required legislation in both houses of parliament. You need first 90 days between the first and the second reading of a bill to amend the constitution in either house. Whether the bill comes into parliament through the National Assembly or through the Senate, you need 90 days between the first and the second reading in that house. After that bill is passed and taken to the other house, it needs 90 days between the first and the second reading. So at a bare minimum, you need 180 days. We only have 128 or 29 days to the general election. Even if you are to come up with a way to introduce the same bill in the two houses at the same time, I don't think you'll have enough time to have the bill passed and the constitution changed.
How did the court get involved in this?
Yes, the human rights groups went to the court to ask the court to compel parliament to pass the laws to bring in gender equality in the elected representatives. And this was because both houses of parliament, the National Assembly and the Senate, failed to pass amendments to the constitution that will set out clearly how there is gender balance in parliament, basically. There is a requirement in the constitution. The law says not more than two-thirds of the elected representatives should be of one gender. So it means that there should be at least 33% of either gender in the house. And in our male-dominated society, that means that there has to be at least 33% of women elected to the house.
The chief judge, John Mativo, is saying that if the parliament failed to enact the legislation within the stipulated time, then, quote, the petitioners, meaning the rights group who brought the case to court, or any other person shall be at liberty to petition the Honorable Chief Justice to advise the president to dissolve the parliament. I'm sure Kenya has separation of powers. If this happened, wouldn't the judge be interfering with the work of the legislature?
No, actually, this is one of the cases where the judge is actually doing the right thing, because it is provided for in the constitution that if parliament does not implement the requirements of the constitution on balance of gender, anybody can go to court to have the court declare that Parliament has failed to do that, and then order Parliament to come up with ways to implement, we call it here the one-third or the two-third gender rule. So the judge is fully within his jurisdictional powers.
Some people call this quota. It suggests that perhaps give women something even if they are not qualified. Is that how some people read it, or some members of the male parliamentarians, would they see it this way?
One of the issues we have with our constitution is that it created 47 women who represent the 47 counties. And that, I think, has become one of the reasons why we don't have that many elected women representing constituents. Because when they go for election, they are told by their political opponents and by the electorate that there's already a seat reserved for a woman in the constitution. So why don't they go for that and then let men contest for the others? I think the constitution itself undermined the role of women by granting them immediate position of woman representative in each county. What I personally think is that parties and the coalitions and political movements should be more compelled to have representatives in their membership so they can have more women, youth and people with disabilities competing for election right from the very grassroots.
John Ingirachu is the parliament editor for the Daily Nation newspaper. He was speaking with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. The United Nations chief in Zimbabwe has rejected recent allegations in the state-owned media that the UN is seeking to interfere in Zimbabwe's 2018 electoral process. Sebastian Mofu has more from Harare.
A majority government-owned newspaper, the Sunday Mail, stirred controversy this month when it published an article accusing the United Nations of plotting to rig upcoming elections to remove President Robert Mugabe from office. Mugabe, who has been in office since independence in 1980, says he will run for another term next year. The Sunday Mail story came just days after an opposition protest in which demonstrators said they had lost confidence in the Electoral Commission and wanted an international body to run the 2018 polls. On Wednesday, Bisho Parajuli, the UN resident coordinator in Zimbabwe, had this to say about accusations of political interference.
Totally false. It's not true. Because we work in everything with the government. In fact, every issue at UN engages, government is aware. We never deal on a political matters like that. We are working purely on development and humanitarian matters.
He was joined at a news conference by Mugabe's chief secretary, Meshack Sibanda, who reaffirmed Parajuli's statement.
UNDP means what? United Nations Development Programme. And their job is to promote development. And this is why we are together. And this is why we have been working together during the first drought we had since 35 years ago, the worst of its kind in the last year. And even only a couple of weeks ago, he was launching the appeal resulting from floods, as well as the devastating effects of Cyclone Danielle. So realistically, I see no issues there. I think it's an issue you want to blow out of proportion.
Floods have claimed almost 300 lives since December, and Zimbabwe is still trying to recover after drought devastated harvest in 2015 and 2016. But political tensions have also been rising, most recently over the purchase of biometric voter registration equipment. The Electoral Commission had initially agreed to have the United Nations purchase the necessary equipment. But last week, the Commission announced the government would purchase it instead. Opposition parties cried foul. On Wednesday, the UN chief in Zimbabwe said decisions about the purchase of the BVR equipment remain up to the government. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, March 30th. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. Gabon's main opposition coalition, which is headed by Jean Ping, has refused to join a national dialogue called by President Ali Bongo because it says Mr. Bongo is an illegitimate president. Mr. Ping's New Republic coalition believes he won the August 2016 presidential election, but Gabon's constitutional court declared Mr. Bongo the winner. President Bongo launched the long-awaited dialogue on Tuesday to ease what he called political tensions in the country. Paul Marie Gonjou is Deputy Executive Secretary General of the National Union Party, which is part of the coalition led by Mr. Ping. He says the opposition will only dialogue with Mr. Bongo if he steps down as president of the country.
The opposition from Mr. Jumping Wing has refused to attend this national dialogue called by Mr. Bongo for one main reason, that Mr. Bongo has not won the election. He has cheated the election. He killed many national Gabonese after the election. We counted at least 100 people dead from those killings by the army. And we think that Mr. Bongo is not legitimate to call for this national dialogue.
But the president thinks that this national dialogue can help to reduce the tension that is in the country caused by the September last year election.
The tension cannot be eased until Mr. Bongo in power. If we have to have a dialogue with him, it's not going to be him as a president. You know, he have to step down and then we can go ahead for a dialogue. How do you want me to go for a dialogue with someone who has cheated the election? What we cannot imagine in the big countries like the U.S. or France or whatever, I mean, cannot be the same in our country.
I guess what you're saying is that is this still the belief of Mr. Jean Ping and your party that President Ali Bongo's election was illegitimate or illegal? And then as a result, are you still asking the court to overturn the results of the September election?
The court has already given Mr. Bongo the winner of this election. We have no confidence on this court. We have no confidence on the Gabonese institution. And the observers from the European Union said that this election is very doubtful. They said that Mr. Bongo, I mean, clearly has not won the election. So if you have these very important people, I mean, coming from the European Union, observing the election in Gabon and at the conclusion said that it's not a legal election or a fair election, how do you want us to say more or to do more? So we said that Mr. Ping has won the election. Mr. Ping should be the president of this country.
So is there any way forward for Mr. Ping? How does the country move forward? The president wants to move forward by suggesting a national dialogue.
Going for this dialogue means for us that we are accepting Mr. Bongo as the president of this country. I don't know if you saw the opening ceremony. You have this man with his lady. They are throning in front of hundreds of people. And we have you have someone from the opposition, someone from the majority coming to speak in front of him. Do you want Mr. Ping coming to the stage and speaking for the opposition in front of Mr. Bongo as a president? This is what you want for us?
Paul Marie Gonjou is the Deputy Executive Secretary General of the National Union Party. He was speaking with me from the Gabonese capital, Libreville. Zambia's main opposition United Party for National Development, UPND, has condemned what it says has been blatant police bias. This after the police prevented UPND leaders from holding a press conference in the capital, Lusaka, on Tuesday. The UPND says this is yet another indication that President Edgar Lungu and his ruling Patriotic Front Party continue to use state institutions to undermine and attack the country's burgeoning democracy. Esther Katongo Mwata, spokesperson for the Zambian police, tells viewers Peter Clotty the opposition UPND party misled the police about its planned news conference.
They were supposed to have a meeting yesterday, and when we did our investigations, we did discover to say that they wanted to have a public meeting under the guise of a press briefing, because even the invitation was open to their members. So it was going to be something big, devoid of elements of a media conference.
But what is the problem here if they invited their members for a news conference that probably could dovetail into something else? It's still their members that are gathering.
But when you look at press conference and the public meeting, they are two different things. In Zambia, here where we are, there's a law which regulates all public gatherings, all public meetings. They are regulated by the Public Order Act. So if they wanted to have their members there and make it a public meeting, they should have followed the provisions of the Public Order Act. There's nothing personal, really, in Zambia police that we have something against them. There's nothing like that. But something correct, the rightful thing has to be followed.
Are you saying they flouted the Public Order Act rule, which they said the government uses to prevent them from holding their meetings and press conferences?
Those are just assertions. Yes, that's what they say, but they did not follow what the Public Order Act says. And if they don't follow what the Public Order Act, it does stipulate what is supposed to be done. So we blocked them from having that. They did not notify the police.
Ms. Muerta, they said this is yet another indication of the professionalism of police they have questioned, and that the police have not been acting as unbiased professionals like the Constitution demands, and that you are just doing the bidding of the government. Let me ask you this.
That same constitution, under the constitution, there are those subsidiary laws, and the Public Order Act is under that subsidiary law of the constitution. So which unprofessionalism are they talking about?
Well, they said in instances where their people have been attacked, the police have refused to apprehend PF cadres who have attacked their people, and that when their people defend themselves, it is UPND supporters who are rather apprehended and prosecuted, and the PF supporters are let to go free.
Let me tell you to say those are just political statements. And as police, we are not politicians. As we follow what is laid down. So any political party, anyone in the political arena who have their own way of, you know, defending themselves or maybe trying to discredit this institution or that institution. So we don't buy that as Zambia police. As Zambia police, we still remain that we are professional and we are going to remain professional. So whatever they say as a political party, they've been allegations which have come. Others have come from the opposition. Others have come from the ruling party. So it is up to us, the Zambia Police Service, to remain focused. And we have remained focused. So whenever we do something that does not please the other party, we are labeled. We will not be moved by that. We will just do what the law demands us to do.
Esther Katongo Muata is the spokesperson for the Zambia Police. She spoke with viewers Peter Clote from the capital, Lusaka. Health experts from around the world convened in Johannesburg this week to try to find solutions that will save the lives of mothers and children in the face of a looming global shortage of health workers and other health challenges, a tough task as the United States is planning to cut its contributions to international aid efforts. Viewers Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
In Uganda, the impact of poor quality health services and a shortage of skilled health workers can be measured in human lives, according to health advocate Farida Luyiga Monje of White Ribbon Alliance.
We are losing 17 mothers and 106 newborns every day.
Monje's sister became part of that grim statistic in 2013, a tragedy she attributes to doctors intervening too late and a lack of blood supplies. Her sister bled to death in a high-end hospital in Kampala, leaving behind four small children. Her baby survived, but was born with cerebral palsy and suffers from developmental delays and convulsions. In rural Uganda, Mwanje says the situation is more grave.
There are no health workers. There's a general lack of life-saving commodities. The infrastructure is poor. Health workers don't have housing. The theaters are dilapidated. Health facilities are not connected to the national power grid. And there's no running water in these facilities.
Worldwide, that shortage and other healthcare challenges lead to 2.4 million preventable deaths of mothers and children every year. By the year 2030, the World Health Organization estimates there will be a shortage of 18 million health workers. Health experts and advocates from 45 countries convened this year in Johannesburg to discuss this looming problem. UNICEF Chief of Health Stefan Peterson told VOA major gains can be made without complicated, costly medical research.
I think we have many effective medical interventions that can save lives, but they don't reach the people who need it, and the people don't reach those interventions at the right time. So what we're talking about now is actually reducing access barriers by making health services more accessible, improving quality of those health services, so that these available and even affordable medical interventions reach the people who need them. And by doing that, we can save at least two-thirds of those lives without new innovation.
He says African countries have also benefited from expanding community health programs with low-level health workers who handle patients' basic needs and shift some of the burden off nurses and doctors. But these changes will require money, and top health officials are concerned about possible funding cuts from the United Nations' largest contributor, the United States. Mwanje agrees.
We are truly concerned that donors are cutting back funding because our governments, well, they're not prioritizing health and they've relied mainly on donor funding. So it will take them a long time to adjust if they actually adjust. So we hope that donors can rethink their decisions and invest in health in countries where there are marginalized people, because we live in a global village and health affects all of us.
That is not, she says, an abstract concept. Every one of those women who die in childbirth, someone's mother, someone's daughter, or someone's sister. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
China is preparing to shut down ivory factories tomorrow, Friday. It is the first phase of the government's plan to end all domestic ivory trade this year. Kenyan conservation group Save the Elephants says such commitment has already had some impact. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Save the Elephants says the wholesale price of ivory in China dropped up to 60% in the last 3 years. The Nairobi-based conservation group says in 2014, a tusk sold wholesale for $2,100 per kilogram. In February of this year, an ivory tusk was sold at $700 per kilogram. Save the Elephants researcher Esmond Martin did the study, which was released Wednesday in Nairobi.
The government of China announced in December last year, 2016, that they were going to close down the ivory factories, the legal ones, and the legal shops. And so what we found was that many of the shops now are diversifying, getting out of ivory, moving into mammoth or other materials.
He says raw ivory sellers have been racing against time and offering lower prices to sell off their remaining stocks. Ivory sales, jewelry and trinkets are popular in China. According to the Global Monitoring System, known as the Elephants Trade Information System, China is by far the largest importer and consumer of ivory in the world. But the founder of Save the Elephants, Ian Douglas Hamilton, says public education campaigns in China are starting to bear fruit.
If you go back beyond that, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, people in China were unaware that if they bought ivory, it would cause the killing of elephants. And there's been a lot of campaigning with Chinese celebrities in which Save the Elephants has taken part to change that mindset.
Tens of thousands of elephants have been killed in recent years for their tusks. The recent Great Elephant Census showed a 30% decline in African savanna elephants between 2007 and 2014. China's decision to ban domestic ivory trade by the end of 2017 was hailed by conservationists. Whether the new policy will reduce poaching remains to be seen. Martin says China must also crack down on illegal trade.
And there are over a million Chinese now living in Africa, and they're buying a lot of ivory retail from big markets in Luanda, in Lagos, in Cairo, Khartoum and other places, and they're 90% of the buyers, and they're bringing that back to China. And they're also buying ivory, which is much cheaper, from their neighboring countries, such as Vietnam, Laos, and Burma.
Last year, Save the Elephants released a report that Chinese ivory buyers are purchasing the product in Vietnam. The group noted in the last decade, the number of ivory items for sale in Vietnam had increased by more than six times. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that's it for this Thursday, March 30th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Bate in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good day.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga, host of Reporters Roundtable. Join us this Thursday as we discuss why workers in Africa are increasingly turning to strikes and protests. Are their concerns being addressed? I'll have a panel of journalists and analysts this Thursday, 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
VOAAfrica.com.
News, features, music from Africa and around the world. You want it? We have it on VOAAfrica.com.
VOAAfrica.com.
All day, all night.